Members in the audience, welcome back. The Secondary Education and Career Development Subcommittee will now come to order. For the record, please remember to turn your, roll call, please, Missy.
Chair McLean.
Here.
Vice Chair Schoof. Ranking Member Bush. Representative Altman is excused. Representative Andrade.
Here.
Representative Benjamin.
Here.
Representative Barrero.
Here.
Representative Fisher is excused. Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative Mello.
Here.
Representative Umfroy. Representative Rizzo. Representative Robinson.
Here.
Representative Sabatini is excused. Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Valdez.
Present.
Representative Woodson.
Here.
Representative Yarborough.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all your electronic devices. Please be recognized by the chair when you're addressing the committee, either as members or as presenters, and make sure you push your microphone button off and on when you're recognized so that you can be heard. Members and audience, welcome back. This morning, we will focus our attention on registered apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship training programs. These programs are a key component of Florida's workforce education. While the traditional four-year pathway has tremendous merit, we also know of more than 30 million mid to high wage jobs nationwide that are held by individuals with more than a high school diploma but less than a bachelor's degree. This important middle represents significant opportunities for growth in registered apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs. In program year 2021, Florida had over 3,300 employers training close to 16,000 registered apprentices in 91 apprenticeable occupations. As these programs continue to expand, we must ensure that program participants are achieving successful outcomes. As you may recall, House Bill 1507 enhanced data collection for apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs in order to track program performance, federal and state investments, and the impact of the program on participant earnings. Today's presentation by the Department of Education will provide a detailed look at Florida's registered apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs, including what these programs are, the various types of models that exist in our state, program sponsorship, program funding sources, student retention and completion, articulation agreements with a college or university, and the status of data collection measures as required by House Bill 1507. The presentation will be followed by a panel discussion with four apprenticeship program sponsors or partners. Presenting today from the Department of Education are Ms. Tara Goodman, the Vice Chancellor for the Division of Career and Adult Education. In her role, Ms. Goodman oversees the Office of Apprenticeship and all career adult education programs. And joining her is Bureau Chief Ms. Kathleen Taylor. Ms. Goodman and Ms. Taylor, thank you both for being here today, and you're recognized to make your presentation.
Good morning, Chair McLean, members of the committee, Representative Schoof, and all other members of the public who are here today to learn about apprenticeship. I can't really top that introduction. I think the chair did a great job of setting the stage for our presentation today from the department. My name is Tara Goodman, and I serve as the Vice Chancellor. Kathleen Taylor and I will be working together on various content areas to present an overview of apprenticeship for you today. As the chair indicated, we're going to first talk to you a little bit about what registered apprenticeship is so that you can understand the model, understand the strengths that we have in Florida related to this model. I am the budget chief for our division over apprenticeship funding, as well as performance for research and evaluation, so I'll be talking today about those accountability measures. And Chief Taylor is going to be talking a lot about all the pathways and programmatic opportunities that individuals who enter these programs have to enter sustainable, life-sustaining wages, which I think is the goal of this committee, creating those pathways and being able to serve the best interest of Florida and have an educated workforce. Chief Taylor is going to start today by giving a quick overview of registered apprenticeship, and then we'll pass it back and forth.
Good morning, and thank you again for the opportunity to present. I'd like to start out with just a little bit of foundational information on the registered apprenticeship model itself. It's important to note that it is truly an employer-driven system. Employers gather, they make the determination of the training program, and they provide structured on-the-job training in specific occupations. And that training actually does culminate in the certificate of completion, which is issued by the Department of Education. There is a minimum requirement of 2,000 hours of structured on-the-job training that is to be supplemented by 144 hours of recommended related technical instruction. And that is part of the Federal Code of Federal Regulation. And so it really does function like a third-party quality assurance system or a third-party accrediting body. It is a way for apprenticeship programs to signal to their apprentices that this is a quality, nationally recognized program. And the purpose of this model is really twofold. It gives employers the opportunity, again, to develop their own training program around their specific industry-recognized standards with the goal of increasing the productivity of their workforce, improving the quality of their workforce, retaining that company knowledge, and ideally retaining those apprentices into full-time employees after they complete their apprenticeship program. For apprentices, likewise, it provides them the opportunity for an on-ramp or a fast track to achieve their career goals. In many cases, apprentices avoid debt. They earn competitive wages from day one, and it really does provide them access to a very specific career pathway. Some key historic milestones to share. The registered apprenticeship system has been recognized at the national level since 1937. We know that this training model has existed for thousands of years, but at the federal level, established in 37. And then in 1939, our records indicate that Miami-Dade Plumbers Joint Apprentice and Educational Committee was established in the state of Florida as a registered apprenticeship program. It is the longest continuously running program that we know of, and today it is training 61 future plumbers. Then in 1947, the state recognized the registered apprenticeship model in Florida statute. And then in 1977, which is not on the slide here, there was another key milestone where at the federal level, the U.S. Department of Labor allowed state agencies to register programs on behalf of the U.S. Department of Labor. And so at that time, Florida was one of 27 states that were registered and recognized as a state approving agency. And essentially what that means is we are registering programs on behalf of the U.S. Department of Labor, and we are issuing those certificates of completion, which are nationally recognized by the U.S. Department of Labor. And then in the intervening years in Florida, we have a strong history of construction, registered apprenticeship programs. That really has been the mainstay. And then in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, we started to see diversification in the kinds of occupations that were registered, moving into telecommunications, as well as firefighter EMT. We have a number of municipalities in Florida that are training their future public safety officials. And then recent history with the passage of House Bill 7071 really did advance policy around the kinds of apprenticeships that may be offered. And that bill removed certain prohibitions that existed on the kinds of occupations that can be offered through registered apprenticeship. And Tara is going to talk a little bit about some of the new advancements around in 1507 and some of the recurring funding therein.
So the members of this committee, as well as the governor's office and members of prior legislators and legislative sessions, have signaled a strong interest the last few years in registered apprenticeship. About, I believe in the first week, first 30 days of office, actually the first week, Governor DeSantis issued a landmark executive order for us, Executive Order 19-31, that set a strong goal for Florida to become number one in workforce education by 2030. We all know the reasons for that. I think that's why your committee was partially formed, was to ensure that we have the best workforce for the best employers to come to Florida and continue the growth, the outstanding growth that we've seen in Florida over the last couple of decades. And we want them to be high demand, high wage jobs for our students today and well into the future. As part of that executive order, the governor signaled very strongly that he wanted resources to support registered apprenticeship, so it did specifically mention in that order a request for $10 million, which was included in the legislative budget request, the governor's budget request, to seed these high-quality apprenticeship program opportunities. And so to create even better and more pathways. So since the governor has been in office, the department has been working very hard on apprenticeship expansion, continuing from the House Bill 7071 that Chief Taylor just mentioned, as well as the recent legislation that was passed last session. One of the landmark opportunities that we had was the $10 million. The governor was successful, and this body did fund $10 million beginning in 1920 to start seeding apprenticeship opportunities. We want to create expanded opportunities in existing programs, and we want to develop new pathways as signaled in House Bill 7071. We tend to think of apprenticeship as construction and architecture and construction career cluster heavy. But that was a clear signal was sent with that change in statute that Florida wants to move beyond that. Those are great jobs in Florida, and we have very fantastic programs in those trades, but we want to extend this model into healthcare, information technology, manufacturing, and additional areas that can help grow our workforce. So we're starting to see the outcomes associated with that initial seed money. We had in 1920, 47 funded proposals. In 2021, 50 funded proposals. So almost 100 funding opportunities have been made available to registered apprenticeship programs that are currently in the process of starting their new programs and registering apprentices. We've just started our new round of competition for 21-22 and hope to be able to announce those awards very soon. That process is underway for competitively reviewing them. As this table shows, there is a strong emphasis on apprenticeship as well as pre-apprenticeship. And Kathleen will talk a little bit later about the pre-apprenticeship model and what role it serves as an on-ramp and pathway to registered apprenticeship. So we have put a focus in the department on ensuring that we have those on-ramp opportunities through pre-apprenticeship programs. Maybe there are individuals in our communities who need additional skills before they're ready to enter into that entry-level position with a registered apprenticeship program, and we want to assure that those on-ramps are available. About 60% of the proposals have been for apprenticeships and about 40% for pre-apprenticeship. The focus has been a little bit more on expansion because we did have a lot of existing programs, but the department has focused very heavily on recruiting new partners, and I believe you'll hear from some of them later today. Miami-Dade College has been a strong partner in starting new apprenticeship programs, but there are many throughout the state. And so the goal is to expand to those non-traditional areas. Some of those non-traditional areas include healthcare. We did, in this most recent round of funding, have, I believe, 10% of our programs funded were in healthcare. We had 15% in manufacturing, 5% in information technology, and 6% in transportation, distribution, and logistics. So while a little more than half were in our traditional architecture and construction cluster, we are starting to see that diversification that was started with House Bill 7071, and we are starting to see our employers step up and understand the role that this model might have in growing their workforce and having employees today who they can train up with the skills that are necessary for their jobs. Some examples of the occupations that we funded in these non-traditional areas include pharmacy technician, medical assisting, surgical technology, and registered nurse resident for individuals who completed their registered nurse program, a one-year on-the-job training opportunity to get them more specialized skills and make them more, better able to do their job in a much more accelerated manner. In manufacturing, we have things like CNC machinist, a welder, CNC programmer, and pipe fitter are some of the examples of programs that we've been able to fund. So we look forward to this next round of proposals, and we hope that we're going to get a lot of good quality ones. We did receive $29 million in requests, so we know we're not going to be able to fund them all, but it is a competitive process for selection, so our goal is to select the best of the best to fund in the future. Next, I'd like to talk a little bit about a bill that was championed by this committee, and we've been working very hard in the department on various aspects of it. Today, I'm going to focus on House Bill 1507's apprenticeship requirements. There were some clear signals in that bill regarding what the department should be focusing our time and attention on, and we've been working to implement many sections of that bill. One of them is very much focused on understanding that we're funding a program that has good performance outcomes. So we have been spending time on that, which I'll talk about. So the law does establish that we should collect additional information necessary to determine program performance. We have some challenges there, but I believe we're going to be able to overcome them. We're going to initiate some new rulemaking to specify standards for retention and completion rates, those kinds of things. We do have an annual apprenticeship report that was started in 2018-19. And we have a lot of expenditure, enrollment information, performance information that is included in that. There are some amendments being made to that to increase and expand the information that we report out on an annual basis. In addition, it signals that it's important for us to have career planning resources such as Apprentice Florida being promoted. So that's another part of the bill that we have been working on. In terms of some of the new reporting related, specifically the Pathways to Career Opportunities grant, we've been funding these projects for two cycles now, and we're entering our third. So the new bill does require us to annually report on our website the number of programs funded and represented, the retention, completion, and employment rates by program and provider, and the starting and ending salaries as categorized by program and provider for those who complete the program. I will say that there is a lag here to many of these outcomes associated with the Pathways to Career Opportunities grant. So we're going to focus first on the things that we do have information on now. Many of our registered apprenticeship programs are 2, 3, 4 years. We're just now starting to see the impact. Some of these programs have only been registered a little bit more than a year. So we're going to be evaluating what we can stage out in terms of reporting out on this, focusing clearly on what we have right now, and then building out those longer term outcomes as students who've entered the program as a result of these grant dollars are able to complete. So that is one of our top priorities. I don't want to bore you with a lot of research and evaluation talk, so I'm going to keep this overview very high. But I think it's important for you to understand the systems that we're dealing with so that you can understand the progress that we're making. Apprenticeship data really exists in two spheres. It exists in this federal sphere and the state one. So we have for the federal side, we have the Registered Apprenticeship Partners Information Management Data System. I'm only going to say that once. We call it RAPIDS. This is our federal system for apprenticeship information. All of our apprenticeship sponsors record apprentice-level information. So actions related to apprentices are included in that. Their enrollment, their completion, their cancellation, perhaps, from the program. And again, this is maintained by the Employment and Training Administration's this is their database. So we live with that database. It does have a lot of good information that we're looking to mine for implementation of the reporting requirements for House Bill 1507. On the school district and Florida College System side, so we have this larger, think of it as a Venn diagram of everyone who's in registered apprenticeship. Then we have another Venn diagram of people who are enrolled in school district and Florida College System institutions. And I'll talk a little bit about the funding structure later, but there is the opportunity for registered apprenticeships to partner with local school districts and Florida College System institutions for support of their programs, and many of them do. And as part of that data system, we get finance data, enrollment data, and some completion data. I put a little asterisk on this one for you to understand that because Hillsboro School District does not issue the certificate of completion for apprenticeship, we have noted as we've undertaken our data review to implement this bill that maybe they don't have access to that information in a timely manner. So one of my goals has been to try and marry these two systems, and we have undertaken some actions that I think are going to allow us to not require duplicate reporting, which would not be in anyone's interest. We don't want to add to the bureaucracy, but be able to match these two systems together. So our focus has been on how do we get RAPIDS to talk to our school district and Florida College System data systems so that we can do the work without the providers having to worry about all of that. Luckily, we do have robust information through our FETPIP placement information program to track employment in Florida and other ways. So we're going to leverage all of those systems to accomplish the goals set forth in House Bill 1507 to improve information on both retention, completion, and those entry, exit, and post-completion wages that everybody is interested in seeing so that we can see the impact of these programs in Florida. We are going to be undertaking rulemaking to do this. We're going to define retention, completion, and all these factors. We believe that next year's registered apprenticeship report will begin to see some of the information that has been reflected in here. Some of the completion information from PCOG, as I mentioned, I'm sorry, I used an acronym, I shouldn't, but we call the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant PCOG because it's a long name. And so we're going to be tracking progress of students in those programs as they entered after the grant was issued, but that does take a little bit of time. Some of them are shorter term, so we're evaluating that right now. But we want to make the rules clear to all of our apprenticeship sponsors on what they need to be collecting locally and make it clear to our educational institutions what they need to be collecting as well to implement this law. Now I'm going to turn it over to Kathleen for a little bit more of a deeper dive into understanding the model itself for registered apprenticeship. It has a lot of great components that we provided an overview for, but she'll go in a little in more depth.
So we're very thankful for some of the advancements from that the legislature has made, as well as some of the initiatives that have been championed by Governor DeSantis. And that has really allowed us to focus now on diversification of the kinds of occupations that we register, and to also create a more diverse talent pool of apprentices. So we are, while we have 91 occupational titles registered with the department, of which most of those are in the construction area as well as in utilities, we are making small but mighty progress in healthcare. After the prohibition on the kinds of occupations was lifted, we quickly moved to register CVS Health. It was our first healthcare program in the state, and that program trains for their future generation of pharmacy technicians. They have just completed or graduated their small cohort, who are now practicing as pharmacy technicians, and they will be onboarding a new cohort in the very near future. And likewise, we have programs, small programs, that are being sponsored by some of our Florida College System institutions, our school district technical colleges, and also private sector sponsors that are training the next generation of medical assistants, patient care technicians, certified nursing assistants, as well as the nurse residency that Tara just described earlier. Likewise, we're making small but mighty progress in the area of manufacturing as well as beginning to see occupational titles and information technology registered with the department. The key authorization of the registered apprenticeship system, as I mentioned, at the federal level, it is the National Apprenticeship Act of 1937, and those key implementing regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations, 29, Part 29, the labor standards for registration of apprenticeship programs. That details all of the standards and components that must be a part of a quality registered program. And then CFR 2930 focuses on equal employment opportunity in apprenticeship, and particularly with our underserved populations of minorities, women, adults with disabilities, formerly incarcerated youth, and so forth. In Florida, we are authorized in Chapter 446 and in our implementing rules from the State Board of Education in Chapter 6A23. I referenced those quality standards. Those really are the quality components that must be a part of every registered program. And I will go into a little bit more depth on every single one of these as we move forward. The backbone of every registered program is employer involvement. Without the employer, we do not have a registered program. And so there's a great deal of flexibility in terms of who can actually sponsor a registered program. In some cases, it may be a single employer. It may be a group of employers who want to join together and register a program on behalf of the participating employers. And then that program is run by a committee, and they administer, and they review, and they monitor and evaluate that particular program. They are also in charge of working with the participating employers. They are the employers who are actually doing the hiring, paying the wages, monitoring the progress, and eventually evaluating the performance and the progression of those apprentices. Currently, or in the 2021 year, we had 258 registered apprenticeship programs. The next key component or standard is around structured on-the-job training. And so if you think of a traditional post-secondary higher ed program, largely teaching and learning is taking place in the classroom, on a campus, online, or in a blended approach. With the apprenticeship model, it really is flipped. The teaching and learning is going on at the work site, and apprentices are working under the guidance and tutelage of an assigned mentor or journey worker. There are several approaches for how on-the-job training may be structured. There is a traditional time-based model, a minimum of 2,000 hours, and students or apprentices' skills and the acquisition of those skills are evaluated based on time. Another sort of emerging model for competency attainment is the competency-based approach, and this is a measure where skill attainment of the apprentice is measured through competency-based. Apprentices can achieve those competencies, demonstrate them at their own pace, and the employer or the journey worker is evaluating their progress in achieving those competencies. I should say all of the competencies, the teaching and learning, all the competencies and the standards are adopted in the standards of apprenticeship. They really function as a roadmap of all of the competencies that an apprentice must demonstrate proficiency in. And then finally, the last training approach, again, this is somewhat of an emerging model, is a hybrid approach, where some of the standards are going to be measured based on time, and then a portion of the standards may be based on competency-based model. I do want to reiterate that irrespective of the training approach, there is a requirement that the apprentice must have 2,000 hours, roughly a year of employment, before we are able to issue that certificate of completion. And so in this model, the majority of the teaching and learning is going on at the work site, and it is supplemented by what is called related technical instruction. And there is a minimum requirement, it's actually a recommendation, of 144 hours per year, per 2,000 hours of on-the-job training, or the equivalent in college credit. It really is designed to provide additional foundational support and theoretical knowledge to support the skills that are being acquired on the work site. The modality of that varies. There's a lot of flexibility. A lot of related technical instruction is provided in a traditional classroom setting. It can be offered in line. It can be offered as a blended learning approach. And likewise, there's a lot of flexibility in terms of who can actually provide the related technical instruction. In some cases, a program sponsor may decide to provide both components, both the on-the-job training as well as the related technical instruction. In some cases, programs make the determination to outsource that training to perhaps a school district technical college or a Florida College System institution, a private college, or possibly even a state university. And then, of course, there are private training providers as well that may be authorized on behalf of the registered apprenticeship program sponsor to provide the related technical instruction. The other key standard adopted in the standards of apprenticeship are the rewards. This is the structured wage schedule. From day one, our apprentices are employed, and they have embedded in their apprenticeship agreement is a structure of wages that they will receive. And so based on an apprentice's progression and specific demonstration of certain milestones, they will receive an increase in their wage. There are safeguards around wages in State Board rule. The starting wage of every apprentice must be no less than 35% of the established mentor wage, and the ending wage must not be less than 75% of the journey worker or mentor wage. And then finally, when the apprentice has progressed and successfully completed those two key components of on-the-job training and the related technical instruction and all of the competencies and skills that were outlined in their apprenticeship agreement, they are eligible to receive their certificate of completion. That is issued by the department, and their program sponsor also signs that. It is essentially the way that apprentices signal that they are fully qualified now to enter the job, to assume the job in which they were trained for through the apprenticeship training model. So how do apprentices come to learn about the registered apprenticeship model to begin with? The primary mechanism is through the pre-apprenticeship pathway. This is the singular on-ramp, if you will, to registered apprenticeship programs. It is authorized in Florida statute, and registered pre-apprenticeship programs must be sponsored by a registered apprenticeship sponsor. And so they work together to determine the duration of time, to determine the curriculum, but essentially it functions to really prepare a pre-apprentice to enter and succeed in registered apprenticeship. The duration of time, they operate from 6 months to 2 years. The curriculum is quite flexible based on what are the needs of that registration of that registered apprenticeship sponsor. They're designed for high school students, out-of-school youth, as well as adults. We have 42 registered pre-apprenticeship programs in 2021, of which 10 were actually focused on high school students. We have roughly 700 registered pre-apprentices, approximately 100 at last count were high school students, which account for approximately 15% of our pre-apprenticeship activity. And then likewise, when we think about when the apprentice comes into the registered model, there are a number of mechanisms that allow them to advance in their career pathway if they choose to. In many cases, when apprentices enter a program, they are eligible to receive advanced standing in that program based on credit for prior learning, either through military or other work experience or perhaps other coursework done in the higher ed sector. In many cases, apprentices may receive college credit or clock hour credit for courses that they take in conjunction with related technical instruction that's offered by a technical college or Florida College System institution, for example. And then upon completion, our apprentice graduates certainly can advance to another degree level through local articulation mechanisms. I'll highlight a couple of those in just a moment. Another way of illustrating the point around how apprenticeship fits into a career pathway approach, if you take a look at the far left in this particular model, this is a model where generally in Florida our program sponsors are providing their own related technical instruction, and in many cases they're not authorized to award college credit or clock hour credit, but in many cases, apprentices can then take those experiences that were offered and receive credit at a college, at a technical college, at a Florida College System institution. A great deal of activity is also occurring with what we call the college-connected apprenticeship model. And if you take a look at that next column, this hybrid, this is where we're seeing a great deal of activity historically, where apprenticeship program sponsors are outsourcing the related instruction to a technical college, to a Florida College System institution, and those apprentices are generating credit. And so that is a great example of that model. We have approximately 47% of our registered programs outsource the related instruction to those institutions. In 2021, 106 of those programs, or 35%, partnered with a technical college to provide the related instruction, 25 programs, or 8%, partnered with a Florida College System to provide that instruction, and then we had 12 programs, or 4%, that partnered with both a technical college or a Florida College System institution. And then moving along, and if you take a look at sort of that last column under college-connected apprenticeship, this is an emerging model, and we're beginning to see it used in Florida where apprentices are enrolled in college credit coursework. We have an example at FIU for their cybersecurity analyst program. Those apprentices are enrolled in a course that renders 3 college credits for cybersecurity. Likewise, South Florida State College has a program where they enroll students in an 8-credit course on the foundations of nursing practice. So apprentices are able to generate college credit as part of their program, generate transcripted credit for that matter. And then in addition, another emerging model in the future may be where students and apprentices can also receive a degree as part of their technical related instruction. And so in addition to receiving a certificate of completion, they may also receive a degree, the award of a degree from an institution. By way of example of some of our current local articulation mechanisms, and these are just a couple. There are many others that we noticed. In particular, I'll highlight St. Petersburg College has an articulation agreement for graduates of the Independent Electrical Contractors Electrical Apprenticeship Program that renders 14 college credits toward the Engineering Technology AS degree. Florida State College at Jacksonville has a similar model for graduates of the Northeast Florida Builders Association Apprenticeship Program that conveys up to 12 college credits towards a technical degree. So how do students and parents and employers hear about this time-tested model of registered apprenticeship? It really is a multi-pronged approach. A lot of the activity is going on locally with sort of the traditional college and career fairs, targeted events that communities are hosting to build a more diverse pool of apprentices, particularly for our underrepresented populations. Another tactic that we have embraced as of late is convening industry accelerator events in key economic sectors. We work in partnership with CareerSource Florida, as well as some U.S. Department of Labor intermediaries. These intermediaries function as subject matter experts for a particular sector. And so we're able to convene employers, share information and awareness about the model, and provide support to those that want to move forward with utilizing the apprenticeship model to train their future generation, the future generation of their workforce. And then I also want to make mention of a comprehensive outreach and recruitment campaign known as Apprentice Florida. This is the culmination of a partnership between the Department of Economic Opportunity, and CareerSource Florida. And it really does endeavor to attract awareness around the registered model for employers in Florida, as well as for our future apprentices in Florida. It is a multimedia platform, and so you are welcome to visit apprenticeflorida.com. This happens to be a still shot of the platform or the website itself. There is a YouTube channel that has a playlist of very robust videos that have employer testimonials, apprentice testimonials, as well as a 5-part video log that explains the process for how to register a program, as well as far more collateral resources that businesses can use. There are toolkits. There's a lot of downloadable collateral and shareable information, and we're very pleased of the work that has gone on with the Apprentice Florida outreach and recruitment campaign. And so with that, I'm going to pass it back to Tara.
So what does all this mean in terms of numbers? So I'm here to close you out by giving you a few numbers very quickly, because I know you guys want to hear from the panel. We've mentioned the 300 apprenticeship programs. This heat map, I hope, gives you an idea of the distribution. I know Florida's a big state, small map. We have about 10 counties that have 10 or more programs. Hillsborough is leading the way. We've got large programs in Broward and Miami-Dade. So I believe this gives you a sense of where the distribution of our current programs are. Obviously, the Panhandle is an area that we want to focus on in the central of Florida as well. These are the top industries that we have apprentices in. Electrician always leads the way. Everybody needs a good electrician, right? A good plumber. So these are very popular programs, but we're also starting to see some of those non-traditional ones like registered nurse resident, some of the manufacturing ones come onto this list as well. In terms of funding, I mentioned earlier, we do have district and college local support that is allowed for apprenticeship programs. We have, for startup, the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant, and that's the only direct source of funding that is provided by this body for registered apprenticeship, for creation and expansion. But school districts and colleges may use their local program funds to support these programs as well. And that's based on a local agreement between the apprenticeship sponsor and educational agency. So there is no standard template for that. There are different arrangements, different facilities might be used. Sometimes it might be the facility of the apprenticeship program, it might be the facility of the educational institution, and some of those factors drive that local arrangement. We also receive federal grant support at the Department of Education level through two grants provided to us by the Department of Labor. We are currently operating under the Apprenticeship State Expansion Grant and in the process of rolling out about half of those funds to local providers to support two grant programs, one for programs and one for reducing barriers to apprentices. We've had a first round of award and a second round of award. We also have, we call it the capacity grant of $450,000, and that's really about supporting us being able to be out in the field more and developing those relationships with employers and continuing to grow the number of sponsors. In our federal state Perkins plan, we authorize the use of this federal source of funds, which are allocated to school districts secondary to post-secondary. Post-secondary institutions are reporting that they are now starting to use this funding source to help support their local registered apprenticeship programs for that related technical instruction. We had, I believe, 17 in our most recent application cycle that reported that they were spending their federal Perkins grant funds to support registered apprenticeship in their communities. In terms of how much these local dollars, these discretionary dollars that the school districts and colleges may use to support, this chart of $26 million is based upon information collected for the annual apprenticeship report. So these are the amounts that districts and colleges report that they spend on registered apprenticeship programs through either their school district workforce development funds or their local community college program funds. In terms of the distribution of those funds by career cluster, they tend to follow the types of programs that we offer. So it is heavily weighted in terms of expenditure to the architecture and construction area, but you can see we have manufacturing, transportation, and we're hoping to see more in other areas as we see the impacts of the actions that are currently being taken as a result of the recent legislation. As the chair led off, we had about 16,000 active apprentices last program year with 3,300 employers. We had a little over 1,000 apprentices completed on time. On time means within 1 year of their expected time of completion. So if it's a two-year program, it could be up to 3 years. Overall, we had 1,875 individuals who received that registered certificate of completion Chief Taylor mentioned. The average exit wage that was reported for all of those was $45,760. This chart shows a recent history. You can see the growth that we're starting to see in the number of our registered apprenticeship programs. And I will tell you, it's hard to understate how critical that we have this line is in light of the challenges that we've had the last couple of years, because apprenticeship tends to be in line with the unemployment rate. When you see the unemployment rate go up, apprenticeship goes down because we don't have as many employers who have the opportunity for those training programs. The fact that we've been able to grow and remain steady in the last couple of years is really a testament to the actions taken by this group, as well as hopefully the department in some respect, in terms of maintaining access to these programs throughout the state. And we have seen a large increase beginning in 1920. I think had recent events not happened, 2021 would have been a banner year for us, but I'm very proud that we've been able to maintain our current activity in light of the last couple of years. In terms of the completion, the rate of on-time completion ranges between 50 to 55% the last 3 years. And the median exit wage ranges around 44 to 45 over these last three periods of time. For your information, I'm not going to go into these in detail, but at the end of your presentation, if you so choose to look at your local community, you can see the grants that might have been received through the Pathways to Career Opportunities grant for the last couple of years. We'll be expanding this when we award our new grants, but we had about 100 grants awarded, and those funds are right now in your communities helping expand registered apprenticeship. And now I'm open for questions.
Ms. Taylor and Ms. Goodman, thank you for your presentation. Members, what I'd like to do is move to our panelists and let them go ahead and introduce themselves, give us a little bit of information about some of the programs that they're running. I had a couple questions myself, and I said, well, that might be something that gets answered by one of the panelists, so I think we'll let them do that if you'll hold your questions, and then I'll let you have at everybody all at once. So, and ma'am, if you can come up here once you make your presentation, then you can just stay up here because we may have questions for you as well. So I'm sorry. Oh, okay. I got to get to my script. I believe you're kicking us off, actually. So, yeah, Ms. Sarah Emanuel, representing the Builders Association of North Central Florida Apprenticeship Program. Ms. Emanuel is joining us here in person. Ms. Emanuel, if you'd like to, you can approach the podium and just give us an idea of some of the programs you're doing. If all of you'd maybe try to take maybe 5 minutes, and that'll get us to right around 10, that'll leave us a fair amount of time. My members here are pretty robust about asking questions, so be prepared for that. And so, Ms. Emanuel, you're recognized.
Good morning, everybody. This is a great opportunity. I'm glad that you guys invited me to come. My name is Sarah Emanuel. I am the training director for the Builders Association of North Central Florida. We're located in Gainesville. This is technically my first year on the job as the training director. I started in January, but I worked on the other side as an assistant with Santa Fe College on the related instruction side, and just really fell in love with the whole program. My son went through the program, and I had a really unique opportunity to take over as the training director the beginning of this year. So I'm really excited to be able to talk about this. Some of the questions for the introduction, I did send you guys a brief summary of our program. We do offer electrical, HVAC, plumbing, and carpentry. Carpentry is a 2-year program, and the rest are a 4-year program. We are, like as they were saying, employee-driven. We have a council. Every year we do wage surveys, we do curriculum review, and they're the ones that determine those wage rates, the increases throughout, and as well as the curriculum. We do use Mike Holt for the electrical curriculum, and then NCCR, which it's very long, and I think I never can remember the full name of it, but they're a nationally recognized, it's the National Center for Construction Education and Research, and that's the curriculum that we use for plumbing, HVAC, and carpentry. And the really unique thing and wonderful thing about it is that their headquarters is in Alachua, which is like 5 miles down the road from my office. So that's really neat to be able to have them right there. And I just recently also completed the master trainer course so that I can actually train our instructors as they come on board. So I'm really excited about that as well. We have partnered with Santa Fe College. They're the ones that provide the related instruction. It's a great partnership. They provide the building, the facilities, the tools. They also pay for the instructors, they are currently underway for a building expansion, which will allow us to increase the HVAC portion of apprenticeship. So we're really excited about that because some of the things holding us back is that we're running out of room. Let's just see if there's anything else. We have seen an increase in apprentices over the past 3 or 4 years, especially in electrical. That's the one that's always the number one. So we're really kind of focusing on the HVAC and the plumbing. But we have been averaging about 240 to 250 apprentices each year. So we're really excited about that. Mm-hmm.
here for us, and then we'll have some questions. Next, Dr. Alexia Roll, Director of Career and Technical Education from Miami-Dade College. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. Thank you for the invite. As stated, my name is Alexia Roll, Director of Career and Technical Education at Miami-Dade College. And in 2018, Miami-Dade College was the first higher education institution in the state of Florida to be designated program sponsor. So we're very proud of that. And since we have registered 7 occupations with the Department of Education, and those occupations are 2 programs in automotive technician, a 1-year program and a 2-year program, a transportation and logistics specialist, customs broker, help desk technician, and our operations general management, which is in the business industry, and lastly, our aircraft structure assembler, which is in aviation. The goal of Miami-Dade College and the leadership of Miami-Dade College is to continue to onboard occupations to make sure that we match our Miami-Dade Beacon Council 7 targeted industries. So thus far, we have 4 of those targeted industries. We are pending development in the life sciences, healthcare industry, banking and finance, and lastly, hospitality. Our largest, I guess our strongest programs are right now in the trade industry, and to Vice Chancellor Goodman and Bureau Chief Taylor's point that yes, we do receive a lot of requests in the trades, but we do have 2 of our occupations that are in non-traditional occupations, so we're very proud about that. It's our programs were range in the wages of starting wages of $14 an hour to $18 an hour, ending anywhere in upwards of $20 an hour, depending on program length and depending on program occupation. In addition, 5 of our occupations are articulated for credit. They are on our credit side of the house because we are an educational institution, and our 2 automotive programs are on the non-credit side of the house. But eventually, the goal is to have a career pathway for those programs to morph over into the credit side where our students can receive credits for those programs. So we're happy that 5 of our programs, definitely our students receive immediate college credit at Miami-Dade College. Lastly, our programs vary in length and in model. You heard about earlier, we have competency-based and hybrid-based programs. And our programs vary in length as well, with 1-year programs, and we have 2 2-year programs. And that is the overview at Miami-Dade College.
Thank you, Dr. Roll, for that. We appreciate it. Next will be Mr. Kirk Barris, representing the Jacksonville Plumbers Pipe Fitters Joint Apprenticeship and Training Trust. Welcome, Mr. Barris.
Thank you. Good morning. And my name is Kirk Barris. I am the director for the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Joint Apprenticeship and Training Trust. I'm also here representing the North Florida Building Trades, which is a consortium of union and non-union construction apprenticeship programs. Right now, we employ and train in the areas of plumbing, pipe fitting, pipe welding, heating and ventilation, general construction. It also includes the sheet metal fabrication and installation, carpentry, millwrights, iron workers, electrical workers, operating engineers, elevator mechanics, insulators, painters, and glazers. Our larger contractors include Haskell, Miller Electric, and WWJ Mechanical in Northeast Florida. Our program currently has 240 registered apprentices, and the North Florida Building Trades comprises of over 1,100 registered apprentices. Our program lengths vary in between 4 and 5 years. As Kathleen Turner had stated, the federal minimum of 144 related technical instruction hours. Our program comprises of 232 hours. Our starting wage with the Jacksonville Plumbers and Pipe Fitters and compensation package is about $24.66 an hour. Again, a 3% guaranteed pay increase every 6 months. And the best part of this is there's 0 student loan debt to our apprentices. Our North Florida Building Trades has an economic impact annually of over $80 million. The average federal student loan debt is over $36,000 per student. and our apprentices are returning $40 back into the economy for every one we get state funds. We do have a tenure completion rate of 86%, and we retain 93% of those over the past 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Barris, for that overview. We appreciate it. And now next, we'll move on to representing Lockheed Martin's apprenticeship program. We'll have Dr. Jerry Ghazi and Amy Motzenbacher are joining us, and you're recognized.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Amy Motzenbacher, and I'm the Strategic Workforce and Apprenticeship Lead at Lockheed Martin. With me is Jerry Ghazi. He's a consultant with the Institute for American Apprenticeship, is an integral part of our Lockheed Martin team. He's here to provide additional subject matter expertise on our registered apprenticeship program nationally and as our work relates to Florida. In your packet, we have provided the committee a wide range of information, so we will focus on a few key points during our oral statement. Lockheed Martin is the number one defense contractor in the U.S., and in Florida alone, we have over 17,000 employees across 64 facilities and generate annual payroll of $1.7 billion for Floridians. As we focus on our mission, we are cognizant of the global competition we face as a country, and there is much at stake, such as our ability to meet both the current and future workforce requirements for new employees, as well as the upskilling requirements for our existing workforce, and the need to transition newer generations of high-tech workers as baby boomer generation retires. We also recognize Florida's desire to compete with other states. And at Lockheed Martin, we never forget the importance of a strong aerospace and defense industrial base to protect our country's national security interests in an environment of growing national security threats. To add to this, the war for talent is real. At Lockheed Martin, we're committed to strategically building talent locally versus taking talent from other businesses through apprenticeships, because it's a win-win for the state of Florida, Floridians, and Lockheed Martin. To do this, we invest in registered apprenticeships for both new employee development and the upskilling of existing employees. We currently employ over 1,400 apprentices across 40 occupational programs, and Florida comprises the largest group of apprentices at 436. Even in the midst of COVID last year, we registered over 300 apprentices in Florida alone across six different occupations, ranging from electronics associate to cyber systems specialist. In fact, Chairman McClain, one of our flagship apprenticeship programs for electronics associates, is right in your backyard in Ocala. This is a prime example of how when we work together with great partners like the College of Central Florida and CareerSource Florida, that we increase our capacity to recruit and develop talent in a region. These are some of the reasons why Lockheed Martin is committed to apprenticeship. And at this time, I will turn it over to Jerry Ghazi to provide additional information about our apprenticeship work.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Lockheed Martin for the opportunity to offer comments about Lockheed Martin's youth apprenticeship. Apprenticeship is about building talent versus buying talent that already exists in the marketplace. If you have a Lockheed Martin site in your district, be assured that Lockheed Martin is working to develop new and upskill existing employees at many of those sites using registered apprenticeship. Lockheed Martin established its USDOL national standards in 2018 and quickly, through the reciprocity statute in Florida, registered those standards with the Florida DOE. Lockheed uses its Ocala site as one of its first pilots for building and implementing registered apprenticeship programs, covering both represented and non-represented workforce. Of the 40 occupational apprenticeship programs registered under its national standards, six are being implemented in Florida, with many more currently under development in its various Florida sites. These programs, 1 to 3 years in duration, invest heavily in a Floridian's participation, providing them with employment, education, and on-the-job work experiences. Much of the education, referred to as related technical instruction, for these programs is delivered by Lockheed Martin, or like in Ocala, jointly delivered by the College of Central Florida, where Lockheed Martin has established a training lab jointly funded as part of the partnership. The employer community college collaboration manifested with this college in an articulation agreement between Lockheed Martin and the College of Central Florida. where apprentices who complete their related instruction can receive 9 college credits from the College of Central Florida mapped to their associate's degree in engineering technology. Investing in the Floridians for these high-demand occupations is a costly proposition. And using apprenticeship, although expensive, is the gold standard for developing such talent. Lockheed Martin's apprenticeship programs are funded by Lockheed Martin's internal training and workforce development budgets, and also by state and federal apprenticeship grants and contracts. And specifically in Florida, has been supported by CareerSource Florida's Quick Response Training Grant, Florida's DOE's Pathways to Career Opportunities, and through CareerSource Florida's local workforce boards, WIOA funding. In summary, we need your help to enable Lockheed to continue to expand registered apprenticeship across all its Florida sites. Apprenticeship programs are key to meeting high-tech workforce requirements of today and the future. Industry invests substantial resources in terms of time, money, and human capital. And employers need to look to cost recovery and cost avoidance programs established by the state to help share in the burden of this workforce investment. Florida should look for additional opportunities to effectively partner with industry to promote apprenticeship and enable Florida to compete with other states. This could be done by expanding Florida's apprenticeship grant program, increasing the reimbursement rate community colleges receive under Florida's tuition exemption statute when a student participates in a registered apprenticeship program, and by the creation of an apprenticeship tax credit, which many states across this country have already enacted into law. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Motzenbacher, and also Dr. Ghazi, thank you for your presentation. All the panelists, thank you for your presentation, and then Ms. Taylor and Ms. Goodman, thank you also. Members, I'm going to open it up for questions now. You can ask the panelists. You can ask those that are here in person. If you can try to recognize who you want to ask the question to, that would be best. And then, obviously, if you ask a question of all of them, panelists, try to keep. We have about 30 minutes left here, and we'd like to get to all of our questions. And certainly, so if you can keep your answers concise, that will help. And so, Representative Valdez beat all of y'all to questions like 30 minutes ago, so I'm going to lead off with Rep. Valdez, and then we'll get to everybody, okay? Thank you. Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair McClain, and thank you, everyone, for this wonderful presentation. This is a very important topic for me personally, and the very first slide, when we talked about what is a registered apprenticeship, you talked about a certificate of completion, and I'm really concerned about using that term certificate of completion because in the pre-K-12 system, we have a certificate of completion for high school graduates that gives them a road to nowhere. Whereas with the apprenticeship, I'm hearing the certificate of completion. Does that also equate to like an industry certification?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Valdez. In terms of the credential that the department issues, that signifies that the apprentice has completed all of the standards of apprenticeship and met all the standards in their apprenticeship agreement. And that primarily consists of they have mastered all of the competencies on the job as part of the on-the-job training component, and they have successfully completed all of the theoretical knowledge that was part of the related technical instruction. And that is the term that is embedded in statute and rule, but it is essentially a credential of value for these apprentices and signifies that they are prepared to do the job that they've been trained for.
Follow-up question?
One.
Real quick.
Yeah, because what I'd like to do is if you have another question on another topic, I'd like to go ahead and kind of get through everybody, and then I'll come back. So okay. Go ahead and follow up.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
So the other question that I had real quick is, just to give others the time also to respond, is some of the challenges that I see, how are you working with the Department of Health and the Department of Nursing to be able to assist in some of our maybe smaller private colleges that are looking to do apprenticeships and increase the workforce in healthcare like LPNs and RNs, and being able to build that articulation agreement with the hospitals. For instance, there's, because of the COVID restrictions, the articulation agreements between hospitals and educational institutions are having a very challenging time in acquiring that articulation agreement. Therefore, we are not able to help with that workforce. So how is it that we're trying to help break down these silos between the departments and being able to move forward in building our workforce in the medical profession?
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again for the question. I'm happy to share just current status in terms of the apprenticeship programs that we have in healthcare. And again, it's a small number, but we are focused primarily right now on really pre-nursing pathways into nursing, primarily certified nursing assistant, and most recently home health aide. We have two programs, Trumont as well as Hamilton Riker, that have registered with us, and they have participating employers that are job sites, that are doctor's offices or skilled nursing facilities or hospital settings that are employing these individuals who are involved in this work. They are preparing to become certified nursing assistants and home health aides. We currently do not have any what I would consider pre-licensure nursing apprenticeship programs. The training for that is still very much handled in the academic setting, but most recently an innovation that we registered our first nurse resident apprenticeship program, and that is really focused on that transition to practice. So these are individuals post-licensure. They're licensed by the Board of Nursing. They're employed. They are apprenticing with Trumont, for example. And it's a residency. It's similar to when graduates of medical school graduate and they are placed in residential settings to transition to practice. So that's our current situation. In terms of standing up pre-licensure nursing programs, if we would want to work very closely with the Board of Nursing, as you know, they approve those training programs, they monitor them, and they provide the licensure. So that's our current situation.
You're welcome. We'll move to Vice Chair Schoaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, panel. This question is for DOE. I noticed in the slides you mentioned that the on-time completion rates were around 55%. I just wanted to ask if you have any idea of why we're at that number and what we can do to get it higher.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Schoaf. We're all focused on getting that number higher. One of the tasks that we have that I think has been laid out by the previous bill is to dig a little bit deeper into all of the numbers. So we want to have a standard for each program to be reporting and us calculating their retention and completion rates at the program level to see what challenges we may have in increasing that. But I think, you know, we know where we're starting it. We're starting at around 50 to 55%, and we want to get that number higher.
Good. Good. Good.
You have time for a second question, or you want to wait?
Is it on? Let me work my way through a little bit. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to Dr. Roll. And my concern is the legal field with regards to the paralegal studies and how this program, how apprenticeship can work in tandem with the paralegal industry as really a degree. I know that Miami-Dade offers a degree in paralegal studies as well as the University of Miami. However, this being an attorney and having used paralegals, I know that there's a better method than sending them to degreed programs in order to have them be good paralegals. And so if the university or the college has not looked at this area, I would like to see and speak with you with regards to how we can better use the apprenticeship program in the area of paralegal studies?
Thank you for that recommendation. So to date, Miami-Dade College has not received a request from any of our local law offices, et cetera, on onboarding a paralegal apprentice. Yes, that's something that we would love to speak further with you on. We also agree that in many occupations, especially here in Miami-Dade College, that the industry certification or workforce experience could suffice and not necessarily a two-year or three- or four-year degree is needed. So how we have worked in Miami-Dade College, because of the employer buy-in and the awareness of the employers in Miami-Dade College, is a challenge that we have been presented with. We have developed occupations extremely and directly connected to the employer need. So I will receive calls from either bureau chief or from in local employers stating that they need X talent. And then we move forward to develop the apprenticeship program in that area. But that's music to my ears to hear that that need is in the paralegal occupation, and I would love to speak further about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whip Andrade. Recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. My question is directed to Vice Chancellor Goodman and Chief Taylor. I'm trying to wrap my head around exactly how the state funding is used and weighted and distributed between programs. Is there a specific FTE that's assigned to it? And how does DOE allocate the money between programs?
You're recognized.
So there are two funding streams that seed these funds. We have the School District Workforce Development Funds, and we have the Florida College System Program Funds. On the school district side, we do utilize a workload-based funding model to inform allocations, but at the end of the day, it's a lump sum appropriation for all workforce education. So in the line item, Hillsborough County gets, you know, $25 million, and the local institution makes the determination on how to allocate those funds amongst programs. And that was done many decades ago, I think, to provide maximum flexibility that when local needs change, there could be adaptations. The model does recognize on the school district side the instructional activity and applies standard weights across all program areas. So for example, electrician related technical instruction would be weighted the same as an electrician career certificate program. And then we also have report of the OJT time that is accounted for and on the job training time that is accounted for in the information. And then ultimately that model informs allocations, but it's not a per FTE funding model. So we don't have equalization and equity in those distributions. So not everyone is at 100%. So as a result, it's hard to arrive at that standard number. And the expenditures might vary by institution based on those local arrangements, whose facility is being used and those kinds of things. So we don't have standardization. On the Florida College System side, it's probably even more opaque. I'm not the expert on their model, but they are definitely not a workload-based funding model. They have the same challenges. They have lump sum appropriation. Institutions can elect to use that, but when you do that, you usually have to take the money from elsewhere to do so. One advantage that was given to us in last year's bill was that the Pathways to Career Opportunities grant was expanded to allow at least the initial funding of instructor costs, which had been previously prohibited. So we're hoping that will help seed some of that activity and allow programs to get underway. But I think Dr. Roll and others could probably speak to the funding challenges that our institutions have in maintaining access and starting new programs.
We'll move on to Representative Monfroy. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you so very much, Chair. My question is directed at the state. I took the time to have a conversation with Career Source, and I signed up for an apprenticeship program to see how quickly they responded to me, because I'm one of those people. And they responded rather quickly and they followed up really well. I talked to the state and then I talked to my local Broward County Career Source. My question and maybe my major concern is, With the shift in how the world is running and the global economy, not having more apprenticeship programs within the tech field is concerning to me. What I realized in my conversations with CareerSource was that businesses didn't want to participate in the tech industry, didn't want to participate, or were not jumping in to participate. How do we incentivize on a state level to have these businesses jump in so we can increase that talent pool through apprenticeship programs? That's what I want to know, because I'm one of those people. Thank you.
So our current activities, I think, are primarily focused on recruitment and identification of employers. The pre-apprenticeship pathway model, I think, can be a good way to build those relationships. But we are making inroads. We do have a lot more happening in the information technology cluster, but it's not where we would like it to be. We do have to have the employers willing to engage. I think that's been made clear today. Without an employer who to pay the wages and to have that mentor, I think it's not the model's not going to work until we recruit those people. That's why the department has focused on having more regional representatives to go out and talk to employers to engage in those recruitment activities. In terms of incentives, I'm probably not the best person to ask. I think, Jerry Ghazi had some ideas. I think we're doing what we can right now. I think the Pathways to Career Opportunity is great seed money that we need to leverage better in order to get people attracted to these areas. We are excited to see what programs get funded, and we do want to see information technology increase.
Thank you. Now we'll move on to Representative Yarborough. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair McClain, and good morning to everyone. Thank you for participating with us this morning. I was making some notes during the presentation. I did want to ask kind of a two-part question to the Department of Education, and thank you, Ms. Taylor, Ms. Goodman, for being with us today. First, actually, a comment I wanted to thank you. It wasn't mentioned, but I think it directly relates, is I wanted to thank the department for working with the legislature this past year by putting into the budget, I think it was about $2 million to help with the work-based learning opportunities in the form of pre-apprenticeships, apprenticeships, and other initiatives we can do to help the students 18 years of age and younger to be able to go in and have those opportunities and kind of get teed up for that to prepare them and get that talent pipeline going and help them on a career path. So thank you, and please pass that along. My question is, I noticed slides 9 through 11, it talked about the Pathways to Career Opportunities grant, and it looked like there was some information that was laid out to collect the information and then determine more or less a return on investment. How does the department utilize the grant programs to evaluate the return on investment and determine then if policy changes need to take place? If you could speak to that. Thank you.
You're recognized.
So our first step is going to be to define those essentially numerators and denominators for retention and completion that we're going to use to track the programs that we funded. So when we have a new program, we're going to establish those baselines. Most of these programs have only had this money for about a year. Many of them just closed out their project, and many of the apprentices were 2 to 3 years. So our goal in the next 6 months is to design and develop and complete our rule development, and then begin publishing information on all of the funded projects and the outcomes that we see. Right now, we're really focused on enrollment because that's what we see first in these areas. What are the new students that we're seeing, the new apprentices that we're seeing in these funded programs? And then we will turn our eye to, of those students who are enrolling, what is the completion in those programs look like, so that we do ensure that this seed money is converting in the way that we intended, that we do have good retention, that we do have good completion rates and on-time completion rates, to Vice Chair Shove's point, and making sure that we're using this money effectively.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you for that, Ms. Goodman. Just in follow-up to that, I think in the budget that we're now operating under for the current fiscal year, the legislature funded an additional 2 FTE for that. Are they specifically focusing on what you just outlined, or are there some other areas that they're looking at too to help with the return on investment overall? If you can speak to that briefly. Thank you.
Certainly, that's a great question. We are in the process of filling those positions right now. The focus on those positions will be to ensure that the money is rolling out effectively and being spent in the intended manner, as well as management of those grants. My unit under research evaluation handles all the accountability measures, so we will be working in tandem with that staff. But they're on the ground working with these programs on a day-by-day basis. So those two staff members are going to help us both manage the grants effectively, ensure that they're being awarded appropriately and expended appropriately, that we are tracking those outcomes, and then my unit will take over and publish those reports.
Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Goodman, and everybody else for the presentation. My question is going to be directed at you or Dr. Taylor. My first question had to do with the process itself as an employer-driven process. What would be in place to ensure that the minority employers are included? And you kind of touch it with Representative Homfort's question. The second question that I have has to do with your outreach and recruitment campaign that you mentioned. You mentioned veterans, that's a thumbs up, women, thumbs up again, person with disabilities, minorities. Is there anything in place to focus on the children, the young adults who are aging out of foster care? Because I think that's a group that really needs this type of program. And
you're recognized.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Woodson. In relation to your inquiry about underrepresented populations, in particular our youth who are aging out of foster care, that is certainly, that would be considered an underrepresented population. And we are targeting youth 16 to 24 that have separated from high school, in many cases without a high school diploma. We are really trying to utilize and harness the power of pre-apprenticeship as a primary pathway into apprenticeship program, in particular for out-of-school youth, as well as high school youth, which I mentioned earlier, as a tactic to retain our high school students in high school and have them graduate with a high school diploma. So I think that is one particular tactic. And we also have a great deal of our outreach efforts are focused on serving our underrepresented populations and really increasing the diversity of our talent, of our apprentices. And so as part of the Apprentice Florida campaign that I referenced, there are specific initiatives there. We have a field staff at the department. We have 5 FTE and 2 contractors that operate in field-based offices. Part of their job duties are to do this very thing that you referenced, to promote and to service those that are underrepresented.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's my second question because I had 2 questions.
Okay.
Hey,
Representative, hold your question for a minute. Let me go to Representative Robinson, and then I want the panelists to actually speak to the first question that you just asked, because I think some of them may be using some tools for recruitment that possibly the department obviously approves or whatever, but they probably got some boots on the ground or something. So I would like to hear from the panelists. Representative Robinson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to thank everyone on the panel that spoke to us. This was a really good information, and it's definitely needed. My question had to do with, you said you had lots of application. I can't remember the number that you stated, and you were saying how you know that all of them wouldn't be awarded. When we look at the map that you provided where the different apprenticeship programs are, it really, you know, some places are really lacking. So I wanted to know, when through that process that you have in awarding the apprenticeships, you know, how does that actually work to make sure that all of the different areas are getting what they need? And I know they vary in numbers, you know, but I was actually looking at the numbers according to population, and some of it just don't pan out. So what are we doing there?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that great question. We do look at region because we want to make sure that we are not just continuing to fund the same programs in the same areas. And in terms of, so we want to make sure that we have at least one grant in our different apprenticeship regions. So we take that into account in the scoring criteria in our rank order
to make sure that that's happening so that we're not, you know, sometimes these scores are points apart, tiny little percentage points apart. So we want to make sure that we are funding the best programs, but we're also representing the entire state as well. So we do account for that in the scoring process.
Thank you for that. I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Schoaf. He actually has some questions for the panelists, so let me go ahead and recognize him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the panelists, for those of you with pre-apprenticeship programs, are you running into any types of headwinds with the guidance counselors, school leadership, parents? What's the biggest challenge you face in implementing these programs?
All at once, or one at first, or
this is Kirk Barris. I'd like to address it. And I'll just say that the guidance counselors, it seems to be that their children are told that they have to go to college to make a decent living and support themselves. And nothing could be further from the truth. The skill building trades offer a great pathway into the middle class. And to go back and answer some of the previous questions, we do recruit at Job Corps, the middle schools, the high schools, career and tech centers. This has been going on for years. This is nothing new for us. The skill building trades built the infrastructure of America. We continue to build through this COVID pandemic. And just don't devalue what we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barris. Ms. Manuel, would you want to, I actually was going to ask you and Mr. Barris that question because I would consider you to be non-traditional in the sense of you're not in the education, you know, it's a private sector issue. Would you want to speak to that a little bit too, please?
Just to dovetail off of what he said, that's one of our biggest challenges is there's still that stigma that to be an electrician or a plumber, you know, you're the bottom of the barrel. You're the one who's never cut out for college. You're a felon or it's really hard to overcome that. And so, you know, one of our focuses is that we want to attract the best because, you know, that it's a good career. Like it's a good job and it's, we're trying really hard to change that. We have a career day that we hold at Santa Fe College, and we invite the surrounding high schools. We get about 100 and 150, and the majority come for the pizza, but, you know, the guidance counselors do reach out to the ones that they feel would be appropriate for the program, which is sometimes part of the problem, because they're the ones that are choosing the guys and the ladies who they feel aren't college-bound, so, hey, maybe this is another career path. One student, he was a senior, and they go through each of the departments, and they look and see how a plumber, what a plumber does, what an electrician does, and so forth to try to gain their interest. And then we have our contractors and subcontractors who, you know, will kind of showcase their company and look for employment and things. And I asked one of the students, I said, what was your favorite part? And the kid was like, plumbing. And I said, okay, well, what was so interesting about plumbing? He was like, I think I could do that. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. And the other kid, he goes, I thought plumbing was just you go to people's houses and unclog their dirty toilets. They didn't realize there's new construction. There's so many different avenues with being a plumber. And being a plumber, you could actually open up your own business. And so I think it's just, like you said, that outreach and getting that information out there that it's for anyone. It's for females. It's for minorities. And a lot of our graduates go on and open businesses for themselves and have great careers and make really good money. So I think it's just changing the way that we see apprenticeship.
Thank you. I'm going to recognize Representative Yarborough for a question because he has for the panelists. Panelists, we have about a minute and a half left, so I'll need Representative Yarborough, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chairman. I did want to ask, Mr. Ghazi mentioned during his time speaking earlier some ideas moving forward that could help us in strengthening the partnership between the state and industry as far as expanding the opportunities. So I did want to ask the other panelists if they would offer in, you know, 20, 25 seconds or less, any ideas that you believe could help us in doing that. Thanks.
Dr. Roll, you're recognized if you'd like to answer that.
Sure, absolutely. Initially, I would say that there are other states across the nation that provide incentive to employers that onboard mentees, apprentices, and trainees. That definitely assists with their interest in onboarding apprentices. We, in Miami-Dade, we partner with Career Source South Florida that provide wage reimbursement for WEOA-eligible candidates, and that has been a bonus for us as well. So those are the incentives I feel that we can definitely stress so our employers will buy in a bit of developing and creating apprenticeship programs.
Thank you, Dr. Roll. Members, I know that I'm not able to get all of your questions, but I encourage you to send any questions that you have to Ms. Sanchez. She'll be glad to work with each of either the presenters or the department to make sure that you get your questions answered. Panelists and those of you that are here today, we appreciate the presentation that you made and your time that you spent with this committee. Members, I love all of you. I appreciate all the questions that you always have. This is a robust committee. I tried to tell you that before. There is no further business to come before the committee. Ranking Member Bush moves we rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.